Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the impromptu summit underway in Paris between Secretary of State Kerry and Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, which was initiated by a phone call on Friday from Russia's President Putin to President Obama. Former Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbot, the president of the Brookings Institution, joins us to examine the meaning behind Lavrov's call for neutrality in Ukraine and a new constitution providing for a federal structure, and whether his pledge that we have absolutely no intent or interest in crossing Ukraine's border ends speculation about the next move of the battle-ready Russian army massed on the border. We'll also look into the issue of Transnistria the Russians have raised, which could be the next flashpoint. Then John Pfeffer, the co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus, where he has an article, Brown is the New Black in Russia, joins us to discuss the continuing insistence by Putin and Lavrov that fascists and anti-Semites have taken power in Ukraine and that its new government consists of armed radicals. We'll look into whether the pot is calling the kettle black, given the extent to which ugly right-wing nationalism bubbles beneath the surface in Russia. Then finally, we'll examine an emerging Republican strategy to limit Democratic votes in pivotal swing states in the upcoming midterm election. A nationally recognized expert in election law and campaign finance regulation, Richard Hassan, the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine, joins us to discuss the lead article in Sunday's New York Times, New GOP Bid to Limit Voting in Swing States, and new bills, laws, and administrative rules in Ohio, Wisconsin, and North Carolina aimed at suppressing the Democratic vote that might inspire Democrats to turn out in November. And joining us now is Strobe Talbot, who's the president of the Brookings Institution and a former deputy secretary of state in the Clinton administration, an expert on U.S. foreign policy with specialties on Europe, Russia, South Asia, and nuclear arms control. He's the author of the sixth Brookings essay, Monet's Brandy and Europe's Fate. Welcome to Background Briefing, Strobe Talbot.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you.
And at this point, Secretary of State John Kerry and Sergei Lavrov are in a meeting. The only thing that we've heard from is the photo op on the steps as they went in, where Lavrov cryptically added in English as Kerry said goodbye to the press, good luck and good night. Edward R. Murrow, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure it was cryptic. Maybe it was just a wisecrack.
Yeah. So what have you heard anything about what might be going on inside that meetings at the Russian embassy in Paris?
Well, nothing that surprises. And it's actually pretty clear what's going on. And it's a square off between the United States and Russia on a key question, which is Russia going to allow Ukraine to continue to develop as a truly independent sovereign nation? Or is President Putin going to use the leverage that he already has as a result of having annexed Crimea, which was sovereign Ukrainian territory until all of a sudden it wasn't and became reattached to the Russian Federation, as well as many other levers that he has to put pressure on the Ukrainians. And the United States' goal here is to reinforce the ability of a provisional government, which took the place of a brutal and corrupt dictator whom the Ukrainian people basically drove out of office. There's some quite solid technocrats, moderates who are in charge now, and then there's going to be an election in May. And that election will put in place a new government, and the United States' goal is to make sure that that new government will be able to act as a sovereign government of an independent country.
Well, Strobe Talbot, up until this point, with this Friday phone call and the subsequent pledge by Lavrov that we have absolutely no interest or intent or interest in crossing Ukraine's border, prior to that, there was a sense of alarm. There was reports from the Pentagon suggesting that this was a serious invasion force, if you will. I spoke about a week ago with Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer in Moscow, who's the independent defense analyst with Novaya Gazeta. And he was convinced that Putin was riding high in the polls. He was drunk with power. and that he couldn't allow this election that you just mentioned on May the 25th to go forth, and that he would invade. So given the sense to which, and apparently President Obama was concerned that this may happen, do you think that possibility is off the table?
The possibility of an invasion, Ian?
Yes.
I think the possibility of an invasion is very much on the table. In fact, I'd go a little further than that. Russia, in a sense, has already invaded Ukraine. First of all, they invaded Ukraine for purposes of bringing Crimea, which was granted to Ukraine 60 years ago, back into the Russian Federation. And second, you remember how there were all these characters, many of them with masks and no insignia, in Ukraine before the annexation of Crimea. There are characters of that sort in eastern Ukraine, which is dominated by the Russian-speaking population there, and there are lots and lots of assets in the form of agents, sleeper cells, that kind of thing. Russia is doing everything it can every single day to destabilize Ukraine. So it's true that the tanks haven't crossed the border, but Russia is interfering big time in Ukraine right now. And I'm certain that one of the many ways in which Putin is going to try to get the result he wants, and we'll talk about that in a minute, out of these negotiations, is to put this kind of pressure on Ukraine and indeed on the West, which doesn't want to see an escalation in the crisis.
So we know what the stick is, then what's the carrot here? I mean, I don't, in terms of what Putin is offering, there's no inducement on the part of the Ukrainians. I mean, my understanding is that, I don't know what kind of advice Putin's getting, but the Ukrainian people, and apparently this is a false distinction, the Russian-speaking Ukrainians, because most people do speak Russian, that they don't want an invasion, they don't want bloodshed, and to a large extent, I believe, the Russian people don't want it, although they are sort of, you know, fairly giddy at the moment with the sense of humiliation having been lifted by this so-called victory in Crimea.
Well, you put the matter very, very well. I don't think there's not much of a carrot that's being offered. And by the way, if the Russians were to actually commit an act of intervention with armed force, I have very little doubt. I've talked to Ukrainians and I've talked to people who have just come back from Ukraine that they would find themselves in a shooting war with terrible bloodshed. And that can't be good for anybody. So that's kind of, I guess you could say, I wouldn't call it a carrot. It is something to give the Russians pause. And then there's also the stick that the West has, which is the reasonably well-coordinated and developing escalatory ladder of sanctions to be put on the circle around Putin, on Putin's bank, and perhaps taking the sanctions further, as well as isolating him diplomatically.
So what is then the issue over Transnistria that the Russians have raised apparently in Lavrov's speech before to Russian television before going into this meeting with Kerry and presumably in the meeting with Kerry? What are they talking about in terms of Transnistria, which is often described as the next flashpoint? It is a Russian enclave carved out of Moldova, but it's landlocked by Ukraine. So what do you think the Russians are demanding there?
Well, you've done a very good job of giving your listeners a quick crash course on a piece of land that not too many Americans had heard of until recently. But Transnistria is exactly what you say. It is the next flashpoint. It bears some resemblance to Crimea in that it's an enclave in what is also supposed to be an independent and sovereign state, a former constituent republic of the USSR called Moldova, and the Dniester River runs through it. And on the northeastern bank of that river, there's an overwhelming Russian population for all kinds of complicated historical reasons, whereas the people on the other side of the river are ethnically and linguistically close to the Romanians. And Russia has had virtual control, although not juridical control, under international law over Transnistria. That is to say, the Russian, where the Russian language population of Moldova lives for a long time. And in fact, that problem has festered as a so-called frozen conflict since even before the end of the Soviet Union. But those Russian troops, first of all, are within easy reach of Odessa, which is a very important port on the Black Sea in Ukraine. And if Russia was looking for a pretext to not only annex Transnistria and attach it to Russia, just as it's already done with Crimea, it might also use the several thousand Russian troops who are in Transnistria to move in on Odessa if, contrary to these promises that Lavrov has made, that there is no intention of invading invading Ukraine, which has to be taken with a grain of salt, that would be a very useful instrument for Russia to do so.
Again, I'm speaking with Strobe Talbott, who's the president of the Brookings Institution and former Deputy Secretary of State in the Clinton administration, an expert on U.S. foreign policy with specialties on Europe, Russia, South Asia, and nuclear arms control. He's the author of the sixth Brookings essay, Monet's Brandy and Europe's Fate. So Andrew Cutchins, who's director of the Russian and Eurasian program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., has an article at CNN, "Does Obama Really Understand Putin?" in which he argues that the administration was not prepared that Putin would act so brazenly and that Putin was surprised at how weak Obama's response has been. What's your sense of how President Obama has handled this situation?
I have a lot of respect for Andy Hutchins. He's been a colleague for a long time. I don't see it quite the same way that he does. Not only was everybody in the West surprised at what Putin did with regard to Crimea in the immediate aftermath of the Sochi Olympics, I think Putin himself was surprised. In other words, this was not some longstanding strategy that Putin had. Putin, as Chancellor Merkel of Germany told President Obama after she had a conversation with Putin, Putin is not entirely tethered to reality. He tends to believe with conviction the most fictitious possible conspiracy theories, and he also has much more confidence in his control over a situation than he thinks. He was absolutely dumbfounded by the eruption of people power in Ukraine that swept the dictator Yanukovych out of office, Yanukovych being, in effect, Putin's guy in Ukraine. And he's been kind of making this up as it goes along. So, sure, President Obama was surprised. So was everybody else. And one reason that they were surprised is because we're dealing with somebody who is reckless and improvisational and who believes what are patently false theories about what's going on. That's a pretty dangerous combination.
Well, your colleague at Brookings, Fiona Hill, has written a book along with Clifford Gaddy, The Operative in the Kremlin, which and Cutchins also makes the point that Putin, as an intelligence operative, just quoting here, virtually abandoned by what he and his brethren view as an incompetent Soviet leadership with the collapse. And the ethos of the Russian intelligence officer going back to the foundation of the secret police in the early 19th century centers on their special, almost messianic obligation to save Russia from itself, a task only they were adequately trained for. So is that Putin's mindset in this? Because apparently he didn't talk to the businessman or perhaps even to his own generals when he made this decision.
Yeah, I think Fiona and Cliff, my two colleagues at Brookings, in their book Mr. Putin, have it right. But let's drill down a little further into the irony here, Ian. Yes, just as you said, Putin reviles and wants to reverse the basic premise of what Russian policy was, not just since the end of the Soviet Union when President Yeltsin became the president of post-Soviet Russia. But it really goes back into the Gorbachev period when Gorbachev began to give up reliance on brute force and give up on the big lie, and it introduced perestroika and glasnost and partnership with the West. That was almost a 25-year period where Russia made a break from its own totalitarian past in terms of its internal structure and its confrontational sort of permanent war by other means approach to the outside world. And that was a good thing for Russia. It was a good thing for the rest of the world. And Putin has decided it wasn't a good thing for Russia. And he's going to take Russia back to something that approximates those policies and mindsets that got the Soviet Union into so much trouble and caused it to break up. And the irony here is that you and I would not be talking today about a man named Vladimir Putin. We would have never heard of him had it not been that Boris Yeltsin, who really put those reform policies in place, handpicked Putin to be his successor.
And apparently regretted that at the end, thought it was the worst mistake he ever made, at least.
Well, I never heard. I don't know that he ever went that far. I was with President Clinton in May of 2000 when he, President Clinton, had his summit meeting with then-President Putin, who had just recently taken over from Boris Yeltsin. President Clinton had some deep misgivings from to what he saw, as it were, read in his eyes and heard from his mouth what kind of leader Putin was going to be. And then he went out to former President Yeltsin's dacha and told Boris Yeltsin that, you know, Boris, I'm not sure that this guy that you picked to succeed you has democracy in his heart. That was the way he put it. And Yeltsin looked a little chagrined at that. And boy, has it ever turned out to be true.
Well, of course, one of the reasons that Putin is riding high in the polls in Russia at the moment, with I think 80% approval rating, Sturm Talbot, is that what he's tapping into, this sense of humiliation, which has been assuaged by this kind of jingoism and a sense of almost geopolitical macho that's going on there, is because he's tapping into something real. You know, the Russians do feel humiliated, and the encroachment of NATO heading east is something that really bothers him. I think Putin knows what he's doing when he taps into that.
You're right up to a point, which is to say there is a widespread sense in Russia that Russia has been pushed around throughout its history, by the way. It didn't start with the end of the Soviet Union. But one thing that has changed about Russia is that while it has an extraordinarily powerful autocrat at the top running the show, in fact, I would argue that Putin has more personal power than any Kremlin leader since Joseph Stalin. I mean, even back in the days of Brezhnev had to go to the Politburo to get approval for something of this kind, such as getting approval to go into Afghanistan. Then that didn't turn out so well. But let's not forget that Russia has come a long way. We're not back into the Cold War. We're not back into a Soviet totalitarian state. And there is an incipient civil society, a degree of pluralism, which Putin has tried to rein in. But I think what we're seeing is kind of the first flush of patriotic pride that Crimea has been brought back into Russia. But a lot of Russians, and they're out on the streets on some occasions. There are even voices in the parliament there saying, "We're not sure that this was a terrific idea." And over time, since Russia is now to a degree integrated into the international economy, and a lot of Russians have bank accounts and have their kids in schools in England and take their vacations on the Riviera if we get into a continuation of the sanctions regime, which is going to happen if there aren't some real concessions on the part of the Russians, I don't think Putin will continue to enjoy that much support, including on the part of the rich businessmen, i.e., the oligarchs who are a very important constituency of his.
Well, just in closing, Strobe Talbot, let's just address what we know about what Lavrov said in Nisa on Russian television and what apparently he's talking to to Secretary of State Kerry about at the moment. And that is that he wants a new constitution for Ukraine that provides for a federal structure and that he's calling for neutrality. What do you think that means, and
Well, let me tell you exactly what it means, Ian. And what it means, if he can get it in the form he wants, is totally unacceptable. It means that Moscow wants to dictate to Ukraine the kind of governance system it has, and the one that the Russians want would give Russia even more power in Ukraine because it would be a so-called federation where the Russian-speaking parts of the country would more easily be able to resist policies from Kyiv because they would have the backing from Moscow. And if we're going to take seriously the proposition that Ukraine has been and should be an independent country, its form of government cannot be dictated from outside. But it's going to be up to the Ukrainians to decide whether they're going to have some form of federation. The Russians call themselves the Russian Federation, and they were federalized up until Putin began taking all the power back to Moscow. So Putin is in no position to lecture another country on having a genuine federation. As for neutrality, what the Russians want to do is rule out forever and forever and forever Ukraine being in NATO. Now, I think that issue is moot at the moment. It does not need to be argued. The Ukrainians themselves are saying they do not consider the issue of NATO membership on the table or on the agenda. Leave it that way. I think it would be a very, very big mistake to do what, for example, Henry Kissinger is publicly calling for, and that is to make assurances to Russia that Ukraine will never be in NATO, because the day may come when the circumstances will lead the Ukrainian people to both deserve and want to be in NATO, which is not the case now. So that will have to be resisted, or there will have to be some vague compromise that keeps open the option of what security structures the Ukrainians decide to have in the future, and whatever compromise comes out of these talks must also acknowledge and reinforce the sole right of the Ukrainian people and their government to pick their form of government that they're going to have.
But just in closing, though, if the elections go ahead as scheduled on May the 25th, then it's pretty clear that the Ukrainians want independence and sovereignty, and they're not happy about losing the Crimea. Will then what would Putin's next move be then? I mean, there's apparently a need for some kind of corridor from Russia into Crimea, short of having to build a bridge across the Kerch there. That's what's being discussed as a possible move in terms of that military force that he's massed on that border, and a land corridor down into Crimea.
Well, we're back into the very beginning of our conversation, which is exactly right. The right place for you to take us. We must take with a giant grain of salt, maybe a great big salt lick block of salt, what Sergei Lavrov has said by way of assurances that there will be no intervention. There's a sword of Damocles hanging over the Ukrainians, and it is meant to have exactly the kind of scenario you just described, have them worrying about that, and therefore prepared to make concessions, and also, because the West doesn't want an escalation of this either, to have us, the West, make concessions, and we're just going to have to resist that, because the costs of Russia yet again violating the territorial integrity of Ukraine, invading Ukraine, would bring us, I think, to the most serious crisis that certainly between the West and Moscow since the Cuban Missile Crisis. Nobody wants that, and the Russians certainly don't want that. Or they, and we got to hope that that very powerful guy who's in the Kremlin, but who's also in a reality distortion field, is smart enough or comes under enough pressure not to make that mistake.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Strobe Talbott.
Glad to be with you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Strobe Talbott, who's president of the Brookings Institution and former Deputy Secretary of State in the Clinton administration, an expert on U.S. foreign policy with specialties on Europe, Russia, South Asia, and nuclear arms control. He's the author of the sixth Brookings essay, Monet's Brandy and Europe's Fate. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about whether or not the pot is calling the kettle black in terms of Russia's accusations about fascism and anti-Semites dominating Ukraine.